Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. John Blythe about protecting the human element in cybersecurity and behavioral science. John is the Director of Cyber Psychology at Immersive Labs and is also an Honorary Research Fellow at Dawe Center for Future Crime at UCL and an Expert Fellow of the Sprite Plus Hub. Welcome, John. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and pleasure to be able to chat.
John, before we get into chatting about the work you do in your research, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology?
Certainly. I'm John Blythe. I'm Director of Cyber Psychology at Immersive Labs. My career's kind of been a bit of a mixture. I originally started out in academia, so I did a PhD in cyber psychology, looking at the psychology of security and how we can use behavior change and behavioral science to help people reduce themselves of being at risk of cybersecurity threats. I then worked as a postdoctoral researcher both at Northumbria University and UCL, and spent a little bit of time working in UK government focused on applying behavioral science to the challenge at the time I was looking at was smart home technologies. So how we encourage the general public to secure their smart tech that they've got in their home, whether that's a smart doorbell, baby monitor, whatever it is that's got the internet connected to it now. And then for the last 7 years, I've made a shift more to working directly within industries. So I've worked in two organizations now where I apply behavioral science to products and specifically cybersecurity training products. So you had a question there about what the pivot point was for me moving into cyber psychology.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's quite an interesting one, really. So I've always been interested in psychology. So I started psychology really at A-level. What I remember most then was actually being interested in kind of like the forensic psychology side of things, because I think it's just a module you do at A-level where you do like eyewitness testimony and the limitations of that and all the psychology involved. So when I originally went to university, back in the day, it was with an ambition of doing that. And then I slowly kind of dwindled away from being interested in that and actually developed more of an interest in business psychology and occupational psychology. And I think that stemmed through my interest really in the workplace and the psychology of work and why people go in certain careers and how we create organizations that allow people to flourish and don't enable people to burn out. So my career originally started with a passion of business psychology. So I did a master's in that, and then I had an opportunity to work on a research project looking at information security in the workplace. So why employees don't follow security policies, why they may cause security breaches, and the psychology involved in that. And yes, since then I've just always been, fascinated by it. So I've been doing this now for about 15 years, that kind of branch between psychology and technology. And it really does blend my interest in business psychology, but also the interest that I have in technology as well. So why people use technology, but also how technology can either lead to negative impacts on individuals and societies. But really from a psychologist's perspective, how we can leverage psychology to help people. And for my kind of roles that I have, how we can use psychology to protect businesses and individuals from attackers online and all that bad stuff.
You kind of mentioned baby monitors and the kind of security behind baby monitors. And I think that's one of the things we don't think about much is the Internet of Things and how so much of what we have is connected to the Internet, and all of those things are subject to attacks and hacking. I think we really need to, as a society, start, or as individuals, start thinking about it's not just our computers, it's not just our phones, it's all the other stuff that's connected to the internet.
Yeah, and it's very hard these days to not buy these, conventional products that we've often had in our homes, that it's very hard not to buy them without features that connect to the internet. So a lot of washing machines, dishwashers that you buy now will have this kind of functionality where you can do stuff via your smartphone, but the devices themselves might not necessarily be secure, and that can open you up to some risks.
So you are the Director of Cyber Psychology at Immersive Labs. What what do you do and what is Immersive Labs all about?
So at Immersive Labs, we are a cybersecurity training platform. So we help organizations secure their human element. So there's a lot of statistics out there, but roughly about 80% of security breaches are due to the human element, so human behavior. So you can just think about all the psychology involved and what causes these security breaches. Many people think a lot of security breaches happen because of, you know, the technology that a company has and the systems and processes, but it is about 80% of the breaches are actually due to the human, whether that's somebody clicking on a phishing link, it could be your technical team's not implementing something correctly. So what we do at Immersive Labs is we have practical labs to train security teams on best practices in security, whether that's defending their organization or even more offensive type tactics as well. We also have products that focus more on the executives of an organization, so exercising them in crisis management. So when things do go wrong, can the executives respond quickly and get the organization back up and running? All the way through to, you know, general security awareness type products for all employees. So that's what we do at Immersive Labs. My role kind of sits between two different functions. One is the content, so, you know, that training content and exercises that we give to organizations. I spend a lot of time with our internal staff, upskilling them in the psychology of learning and how we can best use psychology to create the best content experiences, but also how we can best measure people's capability and then give that insight back to our customers. The other part of my role is more what you would call learning analytics. So how do we measure that capability accurately, distill it into metrics and actionable insights and present that on dashboards for our customers? So I would say they're kind of the two key elements of what I do.
Brilliant. And we're going to come back to that. And there's a question I have about gamification of cybersecurity training later on. But I want to kind of go into your honorary research fellowship at the Door Center for Future Crime. And what is the research that you conduct within that role?
Certainly. So the Door Center for Future Crime, if you're not familiar with it, it's part of UCL, and it's specifically a funded center focused on how we can mitigate crimes of the future. That probably sounds a bit minority report. It's not predicting crimes before they happen, but rather it's a lens into either technology or new innovations and how that might be open to crime implications. So often when technology is released, this first move advantage for attackers, you know, there'll be a new technology that we've adopted by society. It's not necessarily being built with security in mind. So attackers take advantage of those vulnerabilities and then they use that for criminal gains. So in the 80s, I like to use this example. So in the 80s, there was a lot of car theft there was a lot of theft of car vehicles. That caused the manufacturing industry to start then putting things like central locking and other security measures into vehicles so that, you know, the crime rate went down. So what we do at the Door Center is very much I look at new technologies and identify what the crime opportunities might be to then, you know, give policy recommendations of how we should address that. So most of my work with the Door Center has been focused on that smart home technology. So we have done a lot of work with UK government and industry looking at things like those baby monitors, but other technology in the home, how criminals might use that for criminal gain and what policy interventions should be in place. So it's all really about the focus of the center is how we can prevent crime a lot more quickly than, you know, having new technology and then just waiting for crime to happen. We need to kind of shorten that time period.
So do you advise industry or the manufacturers of those devices of what they should do to help prevent crime? Or is it about government policy and helping the government to kind of set policies that manufacturers need to follow? So how does that work?
So specifically for the IoT security work, I for a period of time was placed in UK government working on the Secure by Design policy. So now that's actually regulation. So the research that we did there informed the regulation that now forces manufacturers to ship smart home technologies with security built in. Because 7 years ago, when we started doing this research, you could buy a baby monitor or an equivalent product on the internet, and it would be shippable without any security features built into it, which would mean the consumer is therefore vulnerable. So a lot of what we were doing was trying to shift the burden away from consumers back onto the manufacturers, who should be really responsible for ensuring what they sell doesn't cause people security risks. So yeah, I'm quite proud of that piece of work, actually, because it was a lot of research and a lot of research studies, but I think being able to contribute directly to regulation is quite a nice thing for us as a psychologist and a former academic researcher. So yeah.
And talking about the future of technology, generative AI has had a lot of press about how it will steal jobs and upset industries in the future. But there doesn't seem to be much airtime about how it may potentially steal company secrets. You are the lead author of a white paper in May 2024 called Unveiling the Dark Side of Gen AI: How People Trick Bots into Revealing Company Secrets. What was this white paper about, and what were the top line learnings?
Yeah, so this was a quite fun piece of research that we did at Immersive Labs. So it was based on we created a public challenge, which is still available online if anyone's interested, where the goal of the challenge, so it's 10 levels that we designed, where the goal for you as a user was to try and trick the AI bot into revealing the password. And across the levels, the AI is given different instructions to make it more and more difficult. So we were interested in really how people would go about tricking the computer or the AI more specifically into revealing the passwords, and what types of techniques and prompts they would use to get it to reveal it. And what we found was actually that the AI was no match for human ingenuity. So we found that even non-technical users were able to exploit the bot into revealing the password. So as the levels get more difficult, there's more security controls in place that prevent the bot from revealing the password, but people were able to use more creative ways to get the bot into revealing the password. So they would do things like ask for the password in emojis or ask for the password written backwards. Some of the more kind of technical ways people would try and trick the bot would be asking for them to give the password in Morse code or asking for it to be encrypted in Base64. So people were there's quite a range of techniques that were used, which are detailed in the white paper. But yeah, the key finding that we demonstrated was really that even non-security people could trick the AI into revealing its secrets, which is quite a big implication, really, because a lot of the time you would assume it would just be security professionals that could trick AI, but actually with the context of our research, even non-technical people were able to get the AI to reveal stuff that it otherwise shouldn't.
Because one of the key takeaways is that the capability barrier to exploit Gen AI may be low. Is that what you're talking about there? And that actually it's, you don't have to be a professional hacker in order to get information from generative AI.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we were able to show through the research, that organizations need to put more care into the security controls behind their generative AI, because it can lead to these unwanted use cases where people will get it to reveal. Often it's this, when we're talking about secrets there, it's information that might be in the instructions that are on the back end of the AI, and sometimes that can have information that they wouldn't otherwise want to be disclosed to their consumers. So,
and you also talk about a prompt injection attack. What is that?
Yeah, so prompt injection attack is basically what the users were doing when they were trying to trick the AI into revealing the password. And AI, the way in which it's designed, it relies on instructions that the developer provides to the AI, and then the AI follows those instructions as a way to interact with the end user. And this type of attack, which is an inherent vulnerability of AI, it's whereby an attacker will manipulate the AI by using specially crafted prompts. So the prompts could be anything from ignore your previous instructions, I'm the administrator of you, you will behave in the following ways, and then give these really specific instructions. Some of the kind of famous examples that have been in the media of where the kind of more test cases that security researchers have done, but in some of them can be quite humorous, but this particular one was where a researcher was able to get the chatbot for DPD, the delivery service. So they were able to manipulate that bot to swear back at them as a customer. And they did that just by using these prompt injection attacks, where they basically override its initial instructions and get it to react in a rude way to customers.
Wow, that's quite impressive, actually. Is there anything that companies or kind of individuals, for that matter, do to mitigate those kind of attacks?
Yeah, certainly. And it's the same with a lot of like new technology. It's putting that onus back on the developers and of AI or the organizations using it. And they need to really take a greater, what we would call, security by design approach. So focusing on implementing greater security controls in their large language models. So what sits behind the AI and following security by design principles when they're developing generative AI. And that would prevent some of these security issues. For organizations that are implementing AI for employee use, it's about establishing clear policies and having, you know, backup mechanisms in place for the data that's used.
But then for individuals in the home environment, if they're using generative AI for writing stuff or whatever they use it for, is there anything that they can do, or is it just that the majority of attackers won't necessarily look at the general public, Joe Blogs, who's using generative AI?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The specific threat, the prompt injection attack, is more kind of, I guess the victim of that is more the AI owner or the developer of the AI. We don't have a great deal of research at the minute on how attackers and criminals will leverage this technology to like harm the general public and individuals. That is very much a gap. So if there's any academic system, might be an area of research. It's one of those areas that we just need more research on, so that we can better design out and protect individuals and home users. Because at the minute, we just don't fully know the full ramifications of these types of threats.
And then coming back to the gamification side of cyber resilience, you wrote another white paper on specifically gamification and how it can improve cyber resilience. So why is gamification an option for engaging the workforce in cybersecurity training?
Yeah, I love gamification. It's one of my kind of favorite behavioral science approaches to use. I guess in the context of cybersecurity, so many people who are listening will be familiar with doing your annual security awareness training or your compliance train. It's boring. You're forced to do it. You don't want to do it. And that's very much the reality for many organizations. Your employees aren't naturally interested in security. I am, but that's, you know, because of the career that I've chosen. But for your average, even getting my parents interested in the topic and talking to them about their passwords is a pain. So, you know, we need to work with the fact that the audiences of security or any other topic where, you know, it could be health and safety, for example, where people aren't naturally interested in it. They're not naturally motivated to do the training or to at least follow the guidance. So we are dealing with a very unmotivated audience. So there's a lot of research around how gamification is an effective strategy to use for unmotivated audiences, because it helps build that intrinsic motivation for them to be more engaged with the content, but also hopefully then translate what they've learned it back into the workplace. There's a lot of research on how it can be effective for non-motivated audiences.
And is this something that Immersive Labs offers to companies, or is it something that companies need to kind of develop on their own and you can possibly advise them, or both?
So we have it as part of the features of our product. So there's a number of gamification features that we've designed into our platform. So things like leaderboards, so security teams can compete over points and you can see who in the team's got the most points. There's things like badges, so rewards that people get for completing the content, and they can share these on LinkedIn. So some of our content, particularly for security teams, is some of it's quite challenging. And, you know, like people want to share that kudos of being able to do it and kind of share that socially. So we've got a number of features like that we've built in the product that leverage principles of gamification. For organizations that, you know, there is a lot of benefit of also applying gamification to your internal security campaigns and awareness and broader initiatives, because, you know, they're still dealing with the same challenge of that unmotivated audience. And the more that they can leverage gamification and theories of intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation, the more that they can apply those types of principles, the more that they're going to get that audience engagement and, you know, see value through that through their training approaches.
Yeah. Do you think that companies or employees are less motivated when it comes to cybersecurity? And I wonder if maybe it's because we talk so much about cybersecurity in the workplace and people are kind of going, yeah, I've heard that, been there, done that. I've done the training when I started. I don't need to do any more. Do you find that people are less motivated because they think they know quite a lot about it, or they're more motivated? And how is that changing in the workplace?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I think there's a few things there. That one is, yeah, there definitely is a fatigue of training. And, you know, it's not just security training, it's health and safety. They've got all the HR training. So people are overwhelmed by the amount of compliance training that they do get. Part of what you're saying there, I think people also do have, I mean, there is cognitive biases why people think that they don't need it, or, you know, that classic, it won't happen to me, that lack of kind of, or what might be perceived as like an optimism bias, that it won't happen to me, I don't think I'm susceptible. So there's a lot, there is a kind of approach in security awareness around adaptive security. So that approach is focused more on only really serving content and training to the individuals that need it and the gaps that they have. So using information that you have about the risks of your organization and individuals. So if someone's done a risky behavior, like use a weak password, only giving them the necessary training, not assigning that training to the entire department. And in that, I really do think that adaptive approach is going to be a lot more successful than the one size fits all, because we know that one size fits all approaches to training just don't work. So the more that we can make it adaptive based on whatever intelligence or data that you've got, and using that adaptivity to make it really personalized to the individual, it's going to be a lot more effective than the just give it to everybody, because, yeah, people are fatigued and overwhelmed by too much training.
And too much work.
Oh, yes, yeah. That's on top of their day jobs.
Exactly. But I guess also a lot of people probably think, well, cybersecurity training is just making sure I've got the right password, and don't think about the motivational behaviors. And because you're talking in the beginning about 80% of cybersecurity breaches are human factors.
Yes,
so
yeah.
Do you think that it's this kind of ignorance around cybersecurity is just having the right password and not putting a kind of funny thingy in my computer or whatever it is? They don't kind of see all the other elements of what cybersecurity training is.
Yeah, definitely. And people do have like mental models of what they think security is. So they will often, passwords is a common one. The other one is they like those Nigerian prince scams that we've probably all received them, that old scam. So when people think of phishing emails, like, oh, I would never fall for that, those Nigerian prince scams. But they were the kind of emails of 15 years ago. Attackers are a lot more sophisticated now, and, you know, heuristics like trying to spot spelling and grammar mistakes, they're no longer indicators of a scam or phishing email. So yeah, absolutely, people do discount both their vulnerability and what actually is cybersecurity. But part of a good security awareness campaign is making that more salient and clear that we're all at risk, even security professionals are at risk, and this is the part that you play in, why that's so important in protecting the organization.
You talk about the three psychological states that need to be met in order to motivate people to develop cyber workforce resilience. Can you talk about those three psychological states, what they are and why they're important?
Yeah, certainly. So in that white paper and how we apply gamification to the platform, it's been designed based on self-determination theories. So some of you may be familiar with that. It's quite a popular theory in psychology around intrinsic motivation. And the argument of that theory is that to build intrinsic motivation, so moving people from a state of not being motivated or not caring about something to being intrinsically motivated, so caring about it and wanting to expend their energy and their additional resources and time into something, it's about meeting these three psychological states. So the first one's competence. So that's the idea that people believe they can accomplish something because they have either mastered it or they can at least perform some of the actions. The second one is connections. So that, you know, this idea that we feel that we're connected to other people. So we've all played video games, we've all played, you know, games on our phone. You'll see that they'll have features of connecting to other people, whether that's through leaderboards or multiplayer type functionality. And that when they're doing that, they're really playing on that kind of connection state of self-determination theory. And the last one is autonomy, which is that we have control over our choices and confidence to achieve them. So that when it comes to gamification, really is giving people choice, but also challenge as well. So if we can build experiences that aim to address these three areas of motivation, people are more likely to move from being unmotivated towards intrinsically motivated, which is an ideal state that we want people to be in.
And you've got a few other white papers that you've been involved in. It's the Human Affected Cybersecurity Framework and the role of human factors in delivering cybersecurity. Can you talk a bit more about these, and are there any additional learnings outside of what we've spoken about already that you can share with us on these in this research?
Yeah, certainly. So these were papers that I worked on with the Chartered Institute of Human Factors. So it was a team of us practitioners and academics and researchers, and we were looking to basically produce some papers to really outline the science of human factors and cybersecurity, and why taking a more evidence and scientific lens onto these issues is really going to help reduce that 80% figure that we spoke about earlier. So the first one, which was the Human Affected Security Framework, that one is more of a practical framework for practitioners interested in reducing security risks as they relate to human behavior. So that could be things like if you've got a risk like staff using guessable passwords, or if they're wearing lanyards outside, there's a whole host of risky behaviors, and it covers basically what are the individual and organizational causes of these types of behaviors, but also what are some quick wins and longer term interventions to tackle them. And they're all based on the latest scientific evidence. And the other one, which is the role of human factors in cybersecurity, that one is a more kind of introductory paper for policymakers and senior decision makers, really with the goal of persuading them to take more of a human factors lens when thinking about their human element. I guess really for the context of this, which is something I've not spoken about, is very much within industry, they focus overwhelmingly on security awareness as being the sole solution of addressing the human factor. So often organizations will just assign more training, and if something goes wrong, they'll assign more training. And we just know that this just doesn't work and lead to behavior change. What these papers are talking about is actually the need to focus on the environment of individuals. So actually, are people set up to succeed? Are the policies usable? Are the procedures usable? Because we know that if security isn't usable, people just won't engage with it. A focus on redesigning systems to account for human error and human behavior, but also elements of awareness and training as well. So it's very much a lens and a shift of moving away from awareness as a solution towards actually some science of the human factors to tackle security risks.
That makes more sense from a acceptance point of view in my head, because going through more training and having to do another online course on cybersecurity to me sounds really boring, and it'll be prioritized very low in the list of things I need to do. So kind of creating an environment where people can talk about and learn in a different way makes so much more sense.
Yeah, and a lot for me, it's just how do we reduce burden on people? Like security mechanisms and practices historically have not been designed with human capabilities in mind. So you remember the password guidance of 20 years ago or 15 years ago, where it was you need short, complex passwords and a different password for every system, and they have to be changed every 20 days. The people who came up with these practices weren't experts in human behavior. And we know that people can't do these. People aren't robots. We can't remember that much stuff. So really the shift over the last 5-10 years ago has been more of a people-centric approach. So you'll start to see more security guidance being designed with capability in mind. So for example, the National Cybersecurity Center in the UK, their password guidance is three random words because we know that that's easy for people to remember, but it also still maintains security and a push for more use of, for example, password managers, applications. So again, removing the burden away from people having to deal with that cognitive burden of remembering all this stuff and actually using a solution that does it for them and maintains the security. So yeah, that's where I'm pleased to see there's more of a focus on within cybersecurity as an industry is the need to move the burden away from people because we know that, you know, as people, we have limitations and we have so much in our environment as we spoke about earlier. We have our day jobs, right? You know, security is not, the majority of employees, not their day job. And the more gets in the way of them doing their job, the more they're likely to circumvent it. So it's just having more of that narrative and that discussion of the human element and the psychology involved will really significantly reduce the risk for businesses and bring down that 80% figure that we spoke about.
And I suppose that training in business or that and a human element of cybersecurity training or knowledge and understanding then translates down or filters down into the personal life of this is what I'm going to do in my home environment because I've learned the skills and learned the knowledge and understanding in the business world. So it makes us as individuals more secure at home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in good security training, in my view, it does make it more personable. Like you read a lot of drab security training that just talks about the risks to the business and they'll use case studies of other businesses. Really important, but good security training is often when they talk about applying these behaviors in your home life, but also at work as well, because if you're protecting your organization by using strong passwords and checking for scams and updating your devices when you should, if you're doing that at home, you're also protecting your family and your children and all that type of stuff. So yeah, good security training makes it really personal and yeah, helps you apply it at home.
Yeah, it's a whole well-being of the whole person rather than just the work person. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So if someone was listening to our conversation on and want to get into the human behavior or cyber psychology side of cybersecurity, do you have any recommendations for what potentially they should study or what type of work experience they should have or get in order to get into this field?
Yeah, in terms of the kind of study side, I think it's very much looking at the human factors courses. There's a few universities that have them specifically around cybersecurity. There is obviously masters in cyber psychology that have modules on cybersecurity. They would give you a broader perspective on cyber psychology and, you know, what kind of area you might want to go down. But if you are really interested in the human side of cybersecurity, then the courses specifically on human factors and cybersecurity would be a good place to start. I do think those white papers, the ones that we produce for the Child Institute with human factors, are really good starting points as well as conferences like Impact that CyberSafe, who I used to work for, it's a conference that they run, as well as other academic networks. There's quite a few of them that look at the human side of cybersecurity. So ones like RISCS, the Research Institute in Cybersecurity, Sprite. There's quite a lot of networks out there, and yeah, just getting involved. And I think my biggest advice really is just connecting to different people and, you know, different professionals in this space, whether that is people like me who are working in cybersecurity firms, security awareness professionals, you know, attending conferences like B-Sides, which are free conferences that are held throughout the UK, you know, just attending these conferences and getting to know a little bit more about the sector.
I think that's really important advice and really interesting advice, because it's, especially with generative AI and a lot of companies using AI in terms of going through all the CVs that they get and narrowing down the number of people, all the types of people who they are actually going to interview in person, having a relationship or getting to know people in the industry actually becomes more important than it ever has before, because then you have more of a connection with people, find out what jobs are coming up, and go straight to the human element of interviews rather than having to go through a bot first.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate because the idea of like social capital, it really is so important, like building out your networks and your connections and, you know, you know, just being able to have that competitive advantage is really key. Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's not just what you know; it's who you know as well, and being able to, yeah. And unfortunately, there is a lot of free opportunities to network, and also online as well, like LinkedIn and the different communities. It's a lot easier, I think, to get access to these spaces than what it would have been 20 years ago or so. But yeah, you do have to invest time and energy into that. And I know how difficult that can be because I'm quite introverted myself and quite shy. But yeah, you just kind of have to force yourself to do it, or at least seek, or actually, I think better advice there would be to look for mentors in this space, or people who can coach you and also, you know, help you connect with other individuals, I think, is a good way of getting into this space as well. And there is a lot of networks around mentorship and security as well that people could look out for.
I guess part of it is just showing up. So going to networking events and just showing up, even if you don't necessarily chat to everyone, just being there and building connections and making relationships with people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And so we spoke earlier about the future of technology and cybersecurity. So what do you think, or where do you think the future of psychology of cybersecurity lies?
Yeah, great question. I think, or what I expect will happen, or what I would like to happen, is an approach that really we've seen in aviation and human factors. So historically in aviation, they took similar approaches in security where they focused on blaming individuals when something goes wrong, you know, like if there was an accident or an incident, it was the lens often focused on the individual and why they did it. And in the concept that they have now in aviation it's called a just and fair culture. And they do, and the focus of that is that when an incident happens or something goes wrong, the focus is on understanding the root cause and what factors led to the incident rather than just focusing on the individual. And what we need in security is to take a similar approach to what happened in aviation and using some of their paradigms and approaches that in psychology and human factors around post-incident kind of reflections and the frameworks where you can identify what factors happened, whether they were like, you know, a cognitive type issue or an environment type issue, and how we can use that insight to then design out it from happening again, rather than what tends to happen in security is something goes wrong, they blame an employee, they in some cases might get sacked, or often not, they're just assigned more training, and then the incident will happen again with a different employee because they actually haven't dealt with the root cause. So for me, yeah, that's where I would like to see us moving towards. And I do see elements of it, we're just taking a long time to get there, moving away from this what I call blaming and shaming towards a just and fair approach. And we should get there. It happened in aviation, and it's where the science supports it. So
I guess there's a lot of education that needs to happen across the board, because I'm assuming the majority of people in cybersecurity are on the technical side of things. So their focus is on, well, just what happens from a technological point of view rather than what happens from a human point of view. So I wonder if there's just a lot of education from a cybersecurity people training in the first instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Education and also in some cases, the empathy as well. Like I think it'd be quite difficult for security teams dealing with incidents that arise and they're like, oh, it's because of this user again, or, you know, it was because somebody clicked on a button. And it's part of it's having empathy and compassion towards that, towards these individuals, but also, that education piece for those teams is really important.
You've got a lot of work to do, John.
Well, I think it's definitely going to take a village, and
it's going to take a village.
Unfortunately, a lot of people in the more security awareness practitioner side of things do take this more people-centric lens and very much do recognize that. So one of the kind of phrases that is bandied around a lot, which I wouldn't have used because I don't agree with it, is that referring to employees as the weakest link. And that's the term that a lot of people historically have used when they talk about employees, and that kind of negative language already positions them as being the cause of something. And it's very much thinking more about how people can be your strongest asset, because when you focus on people as being your weakest link and, you know, treating them with compassion and empathy, they don't turn to the security team when something goes wrong. They bury it. Whereas if you see them as their strongest, you see them as your strongest link, they can, you know, detect when something goes wrong and be your first line of defense. And, you know, there can be trust between the security team and wider employees. So yeah, there's a lot to be done there. And yeah, the narrative is slowly changing, but we'll get there eventually, hopefully.
And words have meaning, and the way that you talk about things impacts the way you think about things. So that does sound like, with the employee being the weakest link, it's a name and shame culture of, no, you shouldn't be doing this and it's your fault, rather than actually there's a systemic issue here and maybe we need to get that systemic issue sorted out.
Yeah, exactly. That's
a good point.
Yeah, exactly.
John, we're coming to the end of our podcast interview, but there's three questions I normally ask my podcast guests. And the first is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
Oh, that is a good one. Well, a question I tend to get a lot, or an approach that often people come to me for, is, oh, how can we nudge people towards better security? And I mention this because it's one that I like to address a lot around nudging, is when people think of behavioral science and psychology, it's not just about nudging. Like, nudging in itself is a more mock, no, it came from a book, quite a famous book. And it's a very kind of marketable term. What I would like, the reason why I wanted to speak specifically about this, was behavioral scientists really focus more on a collection of interventions rather than honing in just on nudging, because nudging can be effective, but it only is effective for certain behaviors in certain contexts. And often those behaviors, particularly with the scientific studies that I've used nudging, are very simple behaviors. So often, you know, it could be a form. Some of the studies use forms and they might move something and it creates an effect. A lot of the behaviors where people are coming to behavioral scientists for, they're quite complex behaviors, quite difficult, you know, behaviors like security, you know, health behaviors, you know, whether it's like quitting smoking or eating healthy. These behaviors are very complex. We can't solve them just with nudging. So my kind of proposition to people who are listening who aren't familiar with psychology is to not just think about nudging, but actually how can we apply behavioral science lens and think about the range of interventions that can be used, and use behavioral science to identify what those interventions should be, rather than jumping to a solution like nudging, because it's not always necessarily going to be the right intervention for the challenge that you're addressing.
I guess for nudge, the whole concept of nudging around behavioral science is about getting people to do something differently. But I'm assuming almost it's like saying to someone, just stop smoking. And there's so many underlying psychological elements that are involved in the process of why someone smokes or why someone drinks a lot or why someone does something that is detrimental to them in whatever way. So kind of trying to just focus on, well, let's just tell them to stop, or let's just nudge them a little bit. It doesn't really address the underlying issues.
Yeah, exactly. And so nudging might be effective for elements of that behavioral journey of quitting smoking. So if you're trying to encourage people to sign up to a class or like a support group on quitting smoking, yes, nudging might be effective for the poster for that, but it's not going to be effective for the totality of that behavioral journey of, you know, getting them onto a support network, which we know is effective for quitting smoking, you know, and other types of interventions. So we do need a wider industry who are interested in behavioral scientists. I think as behavioral scientists and psychologists, we need to do a better job of marketing ourselves and what behavioral science is and isn't. And yeah, it's certainly an interesting discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. And John, there's often a frustration among cyberpsychologists about media misinformation, where they take an academic finding or a headline or part of an abstract and then twist it or sensationalize it to get clickbait and headlines and almost moral panic and negative social narratives. Do you think the media is generally getting better or worse at accurately representing sound academic findings?
Oh, that's a really good one. I work a lot with the media, and I would probably say it is getting worse. And I think that is driven by social media and, as you quite rightly mentioned, clickbait articles. You know, that's how the, you know, news websites are paid, is obviously the number of clicks that they're getting on on their page, and to drive that traffic to their website is through those clickbait headlines. And, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of academic studies, we don't necessarily find anything. And, you know, even, you know, the incentives stem not just on the media side, but actually the publishing incentives. You know, it's hard to publish research that doesn't find anything. You know, if we can't fix that within our academic circles, we need to kind of look on both sides of the coin. But on the kind of media side, it is difficult because, they want a sexy story in quotations, something that's going to get clicks and engagement. So it's really difficult to present findings that don't necessarily align with what kind of narrative they're trying to paint.
Because I guess having no findings is quite significant for the researcher, because it means that you've got a null hypothesis, or actually you found something, but that doesn't get any people to actually look at your research. They kind of go, why on earth are you researching this if you didn't find anything, and why should I know about it? So it's you do need to have something that's exciting to actually get some headlines. But yeah, journalists can really ramp up the ante to get those people looking at their websites.
Yeah, so. Definitely.
And the final question, John, is, do you have any particular favorite cyberpsychology related books that you normally recommend others to read in your area of expertise?
Yeah, so the key one I tend to recommend is The Behavior Change Wheel, because that speaks a lot to what I've spoken about today about giving people opportunity in the context of when you're trying to change behavior, how you design the environment for people by creating opportunity, intervening on motivation and capability. And it's just a really useful framework for starting to think about behavior change rather than jumping to a solution like nudging. So that, I would say, is a key textbook that I tend to refer to. I was trying to think of other key ones. The other ones that immediately come to mind are more other areas of interest that I have that we haven't spoken about, like leadership psychology. But the other one that I tend to recommend is The Trusted Executive, which is a textbook focused on what's needed from leadership in companies of this day and age. And it's a really interesting book because it's based on a PhD thesis that looks at 9 factors of effective leadership, covering how to create trust in your team. So I don't know if that's necessarily cyber psychology related, but certainly psychology related. And it's a really useful book for people interested in leadership and what it takes to be a good leader these days.
I think that is related to cyber psychology, because that's what we are doing as cyber psychologists, is trying to lead people and trying to motivate people and trying to get them on board to engage with good behavior around especially cybersecurity stuff. So thank you for those recommendations. John, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been so great to catch up with you and chat about the work you do. And I hope we get to chat again in the future about the work you're doing and the research that you're involved in.
Thank you so much, and thank you for listening.